books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio. For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show recorded in association with RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwoods, and this is part one of our review of the year. A happy week between Christmas and New Year from everyone at Read On. Well, that's just me, really. And welcome to part one of a two-part review of 2025. Today, six authors picked almost at random from the first 6 months of Read On in 2025. So from January to June, we'll be hearing from Yael van der Wooden, Rachel Kushner, Lucy Edwards, Claire McIntosh, and we'll be paying tribute to narrator Steve Hodson. But first up, from January of 2025, here's author AJ West.
A wave crashes onto the rocks. I scrabble backwards, shoes scraping over wet stone. Take it, William. Drink it quickly. I pinch a paper envelope from my pocket, tap the potassium cyanide crystals into a bottle of scotch, rolling the mixture until the poison drowns and vanishes. A spirit to create a spirit. I whimper, burying my face between my knees. I am afraid, yes. Afraid of death after so many years communing with the dead. The water whispers from rock pools, slaps between legs of sharp stone. I listen for voices, but there is only the sea. How wretched to study the afterlife for so many years only to end here, gripped by a realization more terrible than anything beyond the grave. I am a failure, a fraud. I have travelled so far to arrive nowhere, to become nothing. So let it be.
Now, here on Read On, we speak to many authors and many audiobook narrators. But in AJ West, we're getting a two-for-one, as he's both an award-winning writer and has just narrated his first book, although it wasn't his own book. Now, AJ, you've never been on the show before, so let's go back in time first to 2021, I believe. Tell us about The Spirit Engineer.
Yes, so that was my debut novel, and it's based on the true story of William Jackson Crawford, who in the early 1900s, around the time of the start of the First World War, was one of the world's best known, greatest spiritualist investigators. And he came to my attention via Harry Houdini, the magician's diaries, because Houdini spent much of his career actually debunking fake spirit mediums. And he mentioned about halfway through his diary, William Jackson Crawford in Belfast. And he said he met him and William had shown him photographs of his spirits. And he'd concluded that William was, to use the parlance of the time, he was mad, and then mentioned that tragically William had taken his own life on Picky Rocks in Bangor. Well, I was in Belfast at the time. I'd been working there for 4 years. I'd never heard this story before. And so there began an obsession, really, to discover as much as I could about William's life and also the young spirit medium who was his muse, if I can put it that way. She was only 16 when he started carrying out experiments on her powers, quote unquote. And her name was Kathleen Gollagher, a shirt cutter from a working class district of Belfast. So it was not only this really fascinating true story with a mystery at its heart, it also said something interesting about power between this middle class 30-something year old professor and this 16-year-old quite vulnerable woman. But was she vulnerable at the same time? Because she was precocious, she was clever, and as far as Harry Houdini was concerned, she was pulling the wool over this eminent professor's eyes.
I squint towards the horizon, grimace at the sea where the slate waves whelm and roll, and remember those promising words, death is a beginning. Out there, at the far reaches of the world, I can imagine nothing at all. I sniff the scotch, almonds. Shivering, I place my spectacles beside my jacket. My throat tightens. I catch sight of my pipe, spring to my feet, fling the blasted thing to oblivion. Lost forever. Not so lost as I. A seagull stands in the shingle, wings open, head cocked. It yawns, regarding me with a yellow eye. Is it time? I ask the creature, disgusted by the sound of my own treacherous voice. Is the final experiment about to begin? I grip the glass, chill breeze on my neck. Must I do this horrible thing? To the crash of wind and water beside the creeping tide, I rub my thumb over the mouth of the bottle, rap it three times. Knock, knock, knock. So I am done. There is no escape now. In a moment, I shall listen helplessly to my own voice crying out in agony. How appropriate.
Now, when you're writing about someone real like William Jackson Crawford, you need to tread a bit carefully. What was your research process like?
Well, it was a passion project, I suppose. I spent a lot of time in the archives of various universities and museums, trying to dig up letters and photographs and evidence that had been kind of splintered across not just the UK, actually, but the world, you know, as memorabilia and collector's items from William's experiments and from his correspondence with other spirit investigators and organizations. So I did an awful lot of traveling. But the most important things I did, actually, and I think the listeners might get a sense of what I mean when I say this, is that just standing in a place. So, for instance, William's work in Belfast is now Student Halls, but it's this big, grand, Victorian, cavernous building with a big hall at its heart. And the spaces where he would have taught his classes are still there, albeit now with pods for rooms for students. So there were some funny noises coming from those pods, but I had to try and kind of blank those out with some music and just stand in the space and listen to the reverberation of my voice and the echo of footsteps and the feel of the coolness of the air on my skin as I stood in these places. And they were probably as informative as a document telling me what salary William was paid in 1913. It was an incredible journey. And I actually, through my research, which I was publishing on a website, foolishly as an author, but I was publishing all my research on a website while I was writing the book. And within a week of each other, both families, both descendants of both William and Kathleen, got in touch with me to say, we found your website and we'd like to know what you've found. We'd like to know what you've discovered, because for us, it's kind of folklore. We need some facts. And so I was able to give both families the truth of what had happened to their ancestors. Amazing.
For that full interview, head to Read On number 406. And now, Yael van der Woeden is a writer and teacher who lectures in creative writing and comparative literature in the Netherlands. Her debut novel, The Safekeep, is set in the Netherlands 15 years after the Second World War. Isabel has built herself a solitary life of discipline and strict routine in her late mother's country home, with not a fork or a word out of place. But all is upended when her brother Louis delivers his graceless new girlfriend, Eva, at Isabel's doorstep. As a guest, there to stay the season. In the sweltering heat of summer, Isabel's desperate need for control reaches boiling point. What happens between the two women leads to a revelation which threatens to unravel all she has ever known. The audio version of The Safekeep has dual narrators, Saskia Marleveld and Stina Nielsen.
Sunday morning was spent at church, the smell of varnish and old curtains. Monday morning had the sun beating down broadly, open-armed, and Isabel went to work on the garden. The lilac shrubs needed pruning, and the roses needed tying in. And Isabel rooted around in the ground for other sharp objects that might be found. There was nothing but earth. Monday afternoon, she paid a visit to the solicitor about her allowance. Tuesday, she had an appointment with the upholsterer about the chair. On Wednesday, she did the groceries she didn't trust Nielke to do. And on Thursday, she had tea at the Vandenberg house because Johann was in town, and if Isabel went to him, then he would not come to her, which was how she liked it. Parking by his mother's home, saying her neat hellos, being invited for coffee before dinner. If she did not do this, Johann would take matters into his own hands. He would show up unannounced at her front door, walk himself inside with his keen eyes, and linger in the room, touching things, asking her about life. He would press close in doorways. She did not know what to do when he did this. It made her dizzy, a little nauseated, all of it. But she had been told by Henrik these were only nerves and perfectly normal.
The Safekeep is about a young woman called Isabel who lives in the 1960s in the Netherlands. And Isabel is quite prejudiced and quite repressed and quite alone. She lives in her mother's old home. Her mother is gone. Her brothers have left for the city. And it's just her in this house. And all she ever does, day in, day out, is just keep it in order, clean, and make sure that every little thing is exactly where it's supposed to be. And then one day she finds a shard in the yard. That's how the novel opens, a shard of an old plate. And there's confusion around that because she can't remember a plate ever breaking. And of course, right, she keeps really close track of all these things. So how can she not have known that a plate has broken? And so it starts with that question and a little bit of confusion. What happened in her family's history? What are the things that she remembers or doesn't remember? And then enter Eva. Eva is Isabel's brother's girlfriend, and she comes to the house with the announcement through Louis, the brother, that she will have to stay there for the summer because Louis, the brother, is going on a business trip and she has nowhere else to stay. And Isabel does not enjoy this news. She tries to fight it to no avail because Eva is the polar opposite of Isabel. She's loud and she has this deeply peroxide hair, and her clothing, they're not quite right. It's all badly tailored. She touches things that she shouldn't touch. She misplaces everything. She sleeps late. She wakes up late. And Isabel despises her and does, of course, the thing that we all do when we despise someone is we start following them around the house and stare at them intently. And then things start to actually disappear around the house. First it's a spoon, and then it's a knife, and then it's a bowl. And Isabel, who's already quite an obsessive person, allows her paranoia to escalate. Her paranoia around the house, around things, around Eva, around perhaps the maid. Is the maid seeing things? Is it the supernatural force? And that's the two first chapters of the novel. And beyond that, it goes in all different kinds of directions that I'm not allowed to say much more about without giving away the plot.
Yeah. We'll try and keep spoilers out of this interview. But you say she's quite obsessive at the start. Did you write Isabel as slightly neurodivergent, maybe a bit OCD?
You know, it's a very interesting question because I didn't go about writing her like that full of intent. What I did with her is I've given her a few of my own habits and a few of my own little, let's say, quirks. And then I expanded them, I extrapolated them as much as I could within one person. I made them as extreme as possible. But what I've also done is I've taken a lot of rituals and a lot of things that I've recognized from Calvinist households that, you know, I grew up in part of the Netherlands that's very Calvinist. And Calvinism has as part of its culture a lot of what Isabel shows, right? It has this routine at its heart. It has repression. It has control very much. A very interesting relationship to food as well. Food is it's fuel, right? It's not something that you enjoy, especially not in excess, because then it becomes a sin. So I've thrown all of that into Isabel and mixed it up. And I've had quite a few readers come to me and say that they've either recognized themselves or loved ones in Isabel as a neurodivergent person, which is, for me, I think one of the loveliest things that I can hear, the fact that I've written a character that is part myself, part the culture that I grew up around, and to have this this character that just was created by that resonate with people in whatever way. Because for me as well, I think when I find echoes of myself in characters when I read books, that's really, that can be one of the greatest things about literature, to find parts of yourself strewn about other people's work. So to know that my novel has done that to a degree for others is a huge compliment.
Johann put his hot hand over Isabel's under the table, under the fall of the tablecloth. He kept it on her knee while his mother went on about, did Isabel hear what happened with the hires? The weekly help had been caught stealing. Things had been disappearing for a while, but, oh, just small things, a spoon, a plate. And then, of course, one morning, Mother Hires wakes up, and where is her best necklace? Well, they caught the girl eventually, tipped out her bag before she left. What do you think? A whole drawer of silver came falling out. Knives and forks and... Johann pushed his hand up Isabel's thigh. The fabric of her dress bunched, slid. She excused herself to the bathroom. The house was once a farm and still smelled of straw. Johann's mother didn't grow anything on the land, but kept a lovely rose garden in the back. Isabel rearranged her dress, pinched her stockings into order. When she returned to the table, her breath was even, her hands steady. She stayed for dinner, and then the weather turned. A rumble of fast-moving clouds, wind, a young tree near the end of the pasture bending deeply. Isabel said she must get back before the rain would start. Johann's mother didn't approve. Worried, insisted that Isabel stay longer, or stay the night. They had plenty of rooms. Johann agreed eagerly. He licked his bottom lip. Isabel said she must get back.
Now, you moved to the Netherlands as a child, but yes. How much research went into it? Because you mentioned food. I hadn't known that there was a famine in the Netherlands. But how much research did you do into the period?
Well, quite a lot of research, but also my background as an academic is always focused around narratives of the Second World War in the Netherlands. So it was a topic that I knew quite a lot about. Luckily, I have a lot of resources through my academic work, people and books and articles that I printed when I was 24 that I now found again. I was like, oh, I can use this again. How wonderful. But without giving away too much, there's of course the specific topic about the topic of post-war Netherlands and what happened in that post-war period. The specific angle that I wanted to take, that I found that angle was under-researched. I found one or two really incredibly useful pieces of work. I found one piece of literature, and beyond that, there was very little for the specific angle. I cannot say what angle it is without giving away the crux. But so I had to rely very much on friends and family of people in my community. My father, for example, as well. I asked him many questions about growing up in the 60s. But I also grew up in the Netherlands with a lot of stories. I remember this one time, this man on the street, I was 13, just for context. I was 13 and he stopped me. I was biking home and he stopped me on a bridge. And he asked if I could talk with him a moment. And I was, again, 13. I didn't know how to say no to something like that. And he was, I think he was in his 80s at the time, 70s. And the first thing that he asked me was if I was Jewish. And I said, yes. I mean, I think maybe it's important to also mention that when I was 13, I looked how Anne Frank looked at that age. So looking like that in that part of the Netherlands singled me out in a way that perhaps he wouldn't have in other parts of the world. But so he asked me if I was Jewish, and I said yes. And then he started to tell me that when he was a child, when he was, I think he said 8 years old, he lived in a house opposite that bridge. And that he, one night he heard a commotion outside and he looked out at his bedroom window and saw how the Jewish community of the city was being collected on the other end of the bridge and being put into trucks and carted away. And he was describing how it was snowing and it was midwinter. And I, to this day, I don't know why he wanted to tell me that or what he expected from me. I mean, I didn't know how to respond. I said, I don't know how I respond. I only remember biking away at some point and thinking, why would you tell me this? I'm just a child. But I wondered always if there was part of him that wanted some kind of acknowledgement, or I don't know if forgiveness is the word, but I imagine that he didn't get to speak to a lot of Jewish people in his life and he was only just a child and he wanted to have that connection around that story. So these kinds of stories are the stories that I grew up around from family, friends, but also strangers, or when people would find out that I'm Jewish, would oftentimes just provide their stories without any prompting. And a lot of those stories shaped the post-war Netherlands that I describe in the novel.
Yale van der Wooden speaking to me before The Safekeep won the Women's Prize for Fiction 2025. For that whole interview and an interview with Bart Van Es, head to Read On episode 407. And next, along with some collections of essays, Rachel Kushner has written four novels, two of which have been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. She joined us in 2018 to talk about The Mars Room, and joins me today to talk about Creation Lake. Seductive and cunning American spy for hire, Sadie Smith, has been sent by her mysterious but powerful employers to a remote corner of France. Her mission, to infiltrate a commune of radical eco-activists. And the audio version of Creation Lake is read by Rachel herself.
Neanderthals were prone to depression, he said. He said they were prone to addiction, too, and especially smoking. Although it was likely, he said, that these noble and mysterious talls, as he sometimes referred to the Neanderthals, extracted nicotine from the tobacco plant by a cruder method, such as by chewing its leaves, before that critical point of inflection in the history of the world, when the first man touched the first tobacco leaf to the first fire. Reading this part of Bruno's email, scanning from man to touch to leaf to fire, I pictured a 1950s greaser in a white t-shirt and a black leather jacket as he touches a lit match to the tip of his Camel cigarette and inhales. The greaser leans against a wall, because that is what greasers do, they lean and loiter, and then he exhales. Bruno Lacombe told Pascal in these emails I was secretly reading that the Neanderthals had very large brains, or at least their skulls were very large, and we can safely infer that their skulls were likely filled, Bruno said, with brains. He talked about the impressive size of a tall's brain case using modern metaphors, comparing them to motorcycle engines, which were also measured, he noted, for their displacement. Of all the human-like species who stood upon 2 feet, who roamed the earth for the last 1 million years, Bruno said that the Neanderthal's brain case was way out in front, at a whopping 1,800 cubic centimeters.
The narrator of Creation Lake is a 34-year-old American woman who has arrived in a rural region of south-central western France in order to infiltrate a group of young Parisians who've decamped to this area to live communally, to subsistence farm, and to forge connections to the local farmers.
I pictured a king of the road way out in front. I saw his leather vest, his big gut, legs extended, engineer's boots resting on roomy and chromed forward-mounted foot pegs. His chopper is fitted with ape hangers that he can barely reach, and which he pretends are not making his arms tired, are not causing terrible shooting pains to his lumbar region. We know from their skulls, Bruno said, that Neanderthals had enormous faces. I pictured Joan Crawford, that scale of face, dramatic, brutal, compelling. And thereafter, in the Natural History Museum in my mind, the one I was creating as I read Bruno's emails, its dioramas populated by figures in loincloths with yellow teeth and matted hair, all these ancient people Bruno described, the men too, they all had Joan Crawford's face.
She tells the reader that her name is Sadie. We don't know what her real name is. She's working under an alias and is herself a disgraced former agent for the American government, the FBI, who is now working in the private sector, infiltrating leftist groups. She is blunt, amoral, and calculating, but maybe sees herself as more professional and exacting than, in fact, she is. She is reading the communiques to this group of young people. They have a commune called Le Moulin, just means the mill. Sadie is reading communiques from an elder for the group. This elder, his name is Bruno Lacombe, has rejected civilization almost entirely and has turned to the deep past, the time before the written down, and in fact, lives in a cave on his own property. This is a part of France that has extensive underground limestone caves and caverns. And Bruno is someone who has decided that despite his long life as a person very shaped by the possibility, the horizon of revolution, shaped by May of 1968, he has decided now, the book takes place loosely in 2013, that capitalism is absolutely here to stay, and that the only option is to renovate and even revolutionize consciousness. And he is a hopeful person who sees great meaning in the idea of communicating with all planes of human existence as if he can access them on one plane, which is his underground cavern. He writes these communiques to the group that are sort of full of his own homespun philosophy, slightly lunatic, but then again, to my mind, rather accurate. He describes the condition of modern existence like this. We are currently careening off a cliff in a shiny driverless car. And the question is, how do we exit this car? And as his author, I think it's a fair question.
They had her fair skin and her flaming red hair. A propensity for red hair, Bruno said, had been identified as a genetic trait of the tall, as scientific advancements in gene mapping were made. And beyond such work, such proof, Bruno said, we might employ our natural intuition to suppose that, like typical redheads, the Neanderthals' emotions were strong and acute, spanning the heights and depths.
Best-selling author of I Let You Go, Claire McIntosh, joined me around the release of Other People's Houses, her latest book in the D.S. Leo Bradley and D.C. Fionn Morgan series. We'll talk about that book later on, but first we spoke about the first two books in the series, and also touch on the books I Let You Go and our non-fiction book, I Promise It Won't Always Hurt Like This. But for now, book three in the series, Other People's Houses, is narrated by Chloe and Harrod Davies.
The weather broke overnight, rain drumming onto baked earth and swirling along the pavements. There were few awake to see it, and by the morning, summer was restored. Now the sun is hot and high, despite the early hour. Water has drained into gutters and soaked into the cracked earth, and all that's left of the night's sudden storm is a welcome freshness in the air and the swollen banks of the Yauen. The river tumbles over itself in its effort to reach the lake, rushing over rocks and tree roots in a torrent of white foam. Every now and then, the force of the water dislodges a stick or a handful of moss from the bank and whips it downstream too fast for the eye to follow. 15-year-old Ed Clough is walking along the southern bank, away from the rafting centre. He has been sent to look for a missing kayak, and he is taking his time over it. Ed is supposed to be on kitchen duties this morning, but he spent yesterday evening at a young farmer's rally, and the thought of greasy bacon pans is making his stomach churn. He draws deep lungfuls of clean air and wonders how long he can string out his search. Most of the rafts and canoes are locked in a secure unit at night, but there are a few old yellow kayaks on a rack at the back of the centre, and they occasionally go missing. They are carried aloft by drunk stags and abandoned in the road once enough fun's been had, or they're launched into the river by bored kids. Before Ed started working at the rafting centre, he'd once done exactly that with his best mate, the two of them sprinting down the banks to try and beat the empty vessel to the lake. They'd lost by a country mile, as they'd known they would. White water won't be beaten.
Chloe and Harrod Davies reading from Other People's Houses by my guest, Claire McIntosh. We'll get to that book later on, but first I ask Claire where it all began for Brady and Morgan.
We meet Fionn and Leo at the start of the last party, and we actually meet them when they've spent the night together. They had a one-night stand, and we meet them when Fionn is sneaking out of Leo's bedroom thinking, I'm never going to see this guy again, except that a few hours later, they discover they are both police officers and both assigned to the same case. So that's the start of their relationship. They settle into a working relationship and agree to put all that behind them. And we've now followed them for three books. They're very different people. Fionn is a Welsh-speaking detective from North Wales, and Leo is her counterpart over in Cheshire. He is the city boy. He's the organised, rule follower, methodical, very polite, very sort of sensible. And Fionn is a bit of a maverick. She is often torn between what she should do and what she wants to do, and torn between the sort of rules and regulations of her job and the community in which she lives and works.
The first of two klaxons rings through the crisp air and a cheer goes up. Ready? As I'll ever be. Coats and robes are cast aside, towels draped over waiting arms and hot water bottles readied for the return. There's a rush for the shore, a tangle of white limbs and bathing suits, brave bikinis and judicious woolly hats, and excited chatter so loud they wonder as if they might miss the second klaxon. But when it sounds, there's no mistaking it, and they let out a whoop and a "Bloy then now we're there!" as they run towards the lake, screaming as they reach the icy water. When they're deep enough, they plunge, mind over matter through the low-lying mist, cold clamps of vice around their chests, mouths opening in shock as their breath is wrenched away.
"Keep moving! Keep moving!"
cry the veterans, dopamine pumping smiles to their faces. Ripples become waves, the movement of people this way and that as the wind picks up and sends shivers across shoulders. As the mist begins to clear, a woman cries out. It stands out among the screams of excitement, sending shivers of a different kind down the backs of those waiting on the shore. Those still in their depth stand on tiptoes, straining to see what's happening. Who's hurt? The rescue boat dips its oars into the water, in and out, making its way towards the commotion. Out of the mist floats a man, face down and quite unmistakably dead.
Now, the last party started with a trip to the lake, and your crime writer's mind imagined a body floating across it.
This is the thing about being I think any kind of writer is that we are constantly seeing stories, picking up characters, living a fantasy world in our heads, I suppose. And so you and I could be, you know, walking through a wood together, and you might be thinking about the leaves crunching underfoot and imagining how sort of atmospheric it is, how beautiful it is. And I would be potentially thinking about whether I could bury a body, here and how long before it would be discovered. And on this particular occasion, it was New Year's Day, and I was about to go into the lake for our traditional New Year's Day swim. And everyone around me was talking about this mirror flat lake and the mountains reflected in it and how lucky we were and how beautiful it was. And it was beautiful, but all I could see in my head was a body floating through this very still freezing water and the resulting chaos as everyone on the shore and you know, getting into the water saw it too. And it just felt like the start of a novel. And so I went home and started thinking about it. And while that was going on, we went into lockdown. So the pandemic hit. This was, I'd had this sort of vision in January 2020. And then by the end of February, I guess, we were in lockdown and borders became really important. And the border between England and Wales became really significant because we, in Wales, we have devolved health authorities. And so we had different laws. You know, you could go out in England and you couldn't in Wales, or vice versa, you couldn't cross the border. And so suddenly we had this sort of hard border where we hadn't before. Now, I didn't want to write about the pandemic, but I did want to explore this divide.
For that full interview with Claire McIntosh, head to Read On number 416. Now, back in February of 2025, we lost a great friend and a great voice. Familiar voice to RNIB Talking Book users, Steve Hodson has passed away at the age of 77. He was a member of BBC Radio's Drama Repertory Company for almost 40 years, and people of a certain age will remember him in Follyfoot from 1971 to 1973. Here he is telling us how he started narrating for Talking Books.
I had been away from London for years. I'd been up north doing a television programme. And I came back, and I'd only been back about 6 months, and I got a phone call from the man who then ran Talking Books. He was called Ian Turner. He said, "Would you like to do a book?" And I went, "Wow, yes." And so I did one. It's a tester, really. I think it was based up north. I was born in Yorkshire, so the accent was all right. And then I recorded that, and about a week or so later, when it had all been prepped, supposedly, I got a phone call, "Would you like another?" And I said yes, and that was 1975. Even when I went away sort of filming or doing a telly or in theatre, I always had an RNIB book in my bag either to prep, or I would phone the studios and say, "I've got Wednesday off, I've got a Friday off," and we'd fit. So you're constantly coming in. What's happened here is that I've been asked to do books that I'm not aware of the authors at all, but it's opened me up to them. So I have met new authors and through being here, and that's been fascinating as well. At the moment, I'm doing a book called Gallipoli, which is about the Gallipoli campaign in the First World War, written by a man called Alan Moorhead, a great historian. It's a fascinating book. The week before that, I was doing two young adult books. You know, it really keeps the old brain box going, you know. Because you have to be authorial voice, you get to play the men, the women, the children, you have to be everybody. And be aware exactly of what the author's intending. So it's absolutely fascinating. If you think about it too deeply, it's terrifying. And I've met a lot of blind people. I was once in the BBC club having done a play there. And the voice boomed across the bar saying, "You're Steve Hodson." And it was a blind guy with his guide dog. And he'd just heard my voice talking to someone. And he'd heard loads of books I'd done and things. And he came bounding across the BBC club. And we had a great night. You've got to talk to somebody like him to realise just how much it means. It means that a young historian can keep up with what's going on. Politicians. I mean, I've done all these things, you know. Having done this television series, you used to get fan mail, but I got fan mail from the blind reader. There's nothing like it in the world. You've opened up a whole new world, and books are my passion. I have the hugest personal library. I've got about 6,000 books, which my daughters are now stealing bit by bit. And be able to give that to somebody, it just broke my heart and filled me full of pride as well. And when I decided that really, about 3 or 4 years ago, that I might start retiring and running down things, the one thing I could not give up for the life in me was RNIB. I love it. I've loved working for them throughout. I've seen so many different bosses and engineers and producers. It's been a magical time.
That was Steve Hodson speaking to us 9 years ago. Around about the same time, while he was still recording for Talking Books, I was doing the Talking Books show on RNIB Connect Radio. And I sent him a very loose script where he could fill in the blanks and tell us about one of his favourite Talking Books.
It's been difficult to choose a favourite book. You can imagine I've done an awful lot. Novels, biographies, autobiographies, poetry, all sorts of things. But one I do remember is a book called Master and Margarita by Mikhail Bulgakov. It's a surreal and fantastical book about Satan paying a visit to Moscow. And it's full of weird and wacky creatures, Satan's entourage of little devils. And it is absolutely bizarre.
Allow me to introduce you. Roland began, then interrupted himself. No, really. He looks too ridiculous. Just look what he has done to himself while he was under the bed. The cat, covered in dust and standing on its hind legs, bowed to Margarita. Round its neck, it was now wearing a made-up white bow tie on an elastic band, with a pair of ladies' mother-of-pearl binoculars hanging on a cord. It had also gilded its whiskers. "What have you done?" exclaimed Woland. "Why have you gilded your whiskers? And what on earth do you want with a white tie when you haven't even got any trousers?"
"Trousers don't suit cats, Messiah," replied the cat with great dignity.
"Sit down and stop all this hot air."
"Very well," replied the cat, sitting down. "But I must object. My remarks are by no means all hot air, as you so vulgarly put it, but a series of highly apposite syllogisms, which would be appreciated by such connoisseurs as Sextus Empiricus, Martian Capella, even, who knows, Aristotle himself."
"Check," said Woland.
"Check it is," rejoined the cat, surveying the chessboard through his lorgnette.
"So," Woland turned to Margarita, "let me introduce my retinue. That creature who has been playing the fool is the cat Behemoth. Azazielo and Kuroviev you have already met. This is my maid, Hela. She is prompt, clever, and there's no service she cannot perform for you. A charming and select little band."
It is a thinly veiled critique of Stalinist Russia. No wonder Stalin didn't like Mikhail Bulgakov. I love this writer anyway. I've done a couple of his plays because he also worked at Moscow Arts Theatre. And I like his work a lot. But it stands out in my mind because not long ago I was phoned with the help of the BBC. A young man got in touch with me and said he and his girlfriend were listening to Master and Margarita together, and that they both loved it. But it was going to be her birthday the following week, and he was taking her down to Dorset, and at a certain time on her birthday they were going to be walking along a beach there, and he asked me to phone him at that time. He would hand his phone to his girlfriend, and he wanted me to sing Happy Birthday in the voice I'd used for Satan in the Master and Margarita, which I did. I wish you could have heard her giggles. It was a lot of fun. Apparently they went out and had a very good lunch and far too much red wine afterwards. But it's lovely to be invited to do things like that, just because you've recorded a book. I just hope it carries on forever, even when my teeth have fallen out and I'm totally gaga. Even then, I'll have to be dragged kicking and screaming from the studios. I've loved doing it, particularly because we've had some wonderful responses. We all get them. One woman got in touch once, and she was quite late to Talking Books, but even then a whole new world had opened up for her, and it was just so exciting to hear that, and makes it all worthwhile. Roberts asked if we could finally add a line to end this, written by him, but I'm going to say it from the bottom of my heart. Thanks for listening to Talking Books.
It's been my pleasure.
Oh, the stories I could tell about Steve Hodson. Let's end on a cheerier note with RNIB ambassador and blind author Lucy Edwards. Lucy Edwards is an award-winning blind presenter, content creator and disability activist, who's usually accompanied by her guide dog, Miss Molly. Her new book, Ella Jones vs. the Sun Stealer, is narrated by Sarah Ovens.
The man hears the ancient chest in the cave shake before he sees it. The rattling sound of the heavy chain that has held it closed for centuries echoes off the walls. He spins round to watch the golden glow trapped within the chest escape through the cracks of the lid, filling the dark cave with a dim, wobbling light. A wicked grin breaks across his face.
Sarah Ovens reading from Ella Jones vs. the Sun Stealer by my guest, Lucy Edwards. Now, we've got a few things to talk about, your book, your role as an RNIB ambassador. But if you don't mind, could I start by asking you about your eye condition?
Yes, of course. So I have a really rare genetic condition called incontinenti pigmenti. A bit of a mouthful, I just say IP for short. It runs down the female line of my genes. Although my late grandma nor my mom is blind, it actually presented itself when I was 4 years old as a skin condition on the backs of my legs. It looked a bit like chicken pox, and my mom and dad were really worried, and I got it diagnosed as IP when I was younger, and then it went away and I went for a routine eye check at age 8, and I always say the rest is history, really. They rushed me to the eye hospital and my mom and dad were really, really shocked. So today, as it stands, I am a total. That's what I say, very jovially. I don't mind being blind. I love it, in fact, but it's taken me a long time to get here. I lost my eyesight in my right eye at age 11 through IP and a retinal detachment, and left eye at 17. So yeah, I'm 29 now and I only have occasional days where I can see a bit of light. But yeah, that's me.
This year we're celebrating 200 years of Braille. Did you learn Braille at school?
I did, although I was that typical teenager, like, oh, I'm not blind, I'm never going to be blind. That's what I used to say to my teachers. And they're like, well, you never know. You know, it's a good skill to have, you're visually impaired, you know. And I used to say to my teacher, oh, I just really don't want to do it. But at 15, I did actually learn the alphabet because I was really lucky, actually. I had a visual impairment unit on the side, like plopped on the side of my state school. So there were a lot of different positive influences of blindness around me. And my teacher even had a guide dog, which then kind of prompted me to be like, oh, guide dogs are cute. So yeah, that's when I started. But I think properly, I was about 17 when I first lost my eyesight. And then that's when I was fully into feeling different grains of rice. And is this quinoa? Is this long grain? Is this short grain? And being quite frustrated. But I love Braille. I don't know what I'd do without it. I use it all the time. It's all over everything in my house, in my pantry, you know, in my wardrobe. So yeah, I don't know what I'd do without it.
Now, there's a myth that I've heard so many times that losing one sense enhances the others. Can you confirm or deny that losing your sight has turned you into Daredevil?
I love this. It's such a stereotype. So for me, because I had mobility lessons from the age of 11 with an instructor that obviously taught me how to hone my senses, I always say my senses didn't get better. I didn't suddenly grow an extra ear when I lost my vision. What happened was I just learned how to use them in a different way than, I guess, the quote unquote typical way. So I did learn how to hone into different sounds around me. I can't hear, unfortunately, a pin drop from up the road, although I wish that was the case. But yeah, that's how I always describe it. They're not a lot better than they were.
After straightening his tie and adjusting the cuffs of his tailored jacket, he casually steps over the woman lying unconscious on the ground. He's careful not to tread on her outstretched hand. Glancing down, he sees the intricate sun tattoo on her wrist and sighs heavily. She was a necessary casualty. She would have tried to stop him. The chest is shaking more violently now. As the man cautiously approaches it, he can hear the links of the chain creak and groan as they strain against the force trying to break them apart. Suddenly, the chain breaks, clattering as it falls, its hefty padlock hitting the ground with a loud clunk. The man stops, his eyes widening abruptly, his breath catching. A small oval shape carved into the lid of the chest has begun to glow violet. The cave is momentarily bathed in a radiant purple before the oval stone shakes itself loose and falls, skittering across the ground towards the cave wall. With its light knocked out, it looks like any other grey pebble that you might find on a beach somewhere, smooth and small and dark, one of many such pebbles, all insignificant. The man has forgotten about it already, his attention solely on the chest, which now sits completely still in the corner. It has stopped shaking.
Now, your character, Ella Jones, might not have superpowers, but she is indeed trying to save the world.
Yes, and it was really important to me with my children's book for Ella Jones not to be a superhero because of the trope of Daredevil. I adore Daredevil as a story, but I get a lot of comments on social media about, I guess, that stereotype. And through no fault of anyone's own, they haven't had any other proper, authentic representations of blindness in the media. So people don't necessarily know any better when they're commenting that. But I wanted to create Ella as a really positive force to be reckoned with, really. Yes, she's saving the world. Yes, the world around her is the kind of supernatural thing in a way, but herself, she's just an amazing, conscientious, authentic representation of blindness. She's so amazing, and she lost her eyesight only a few years earlier. She saves the world with her best friend Finn and her sister Poppy and her guide dog Miss Maisie, very much based on Miss Molly, my guide dog. So yeah.
Now, is it the book you wished you could have read at that age?
Oh, absolutely. I used to dream of reading stories about blindness, because when I actually lost my eyesight, I felt so sick and terrified. There was no one around me that was losing their vision, and I didn't see anyone. I wasn't represented in the media. So I thought, oh, well, now I've lost my eyesight. I'm 17. What do I do? I almost thought that I couldn't have any dreams, and, you know, I went into depression because of that, because, you know, it's almost like society didn't have an expectation of me. So then I didn't have an expectation of myself to, amount to anything. And that for me is so sad. And when I wake up every morning, I think of my why. And I think, you know, people who are losing their eyesight now, kids, older adults, they need to see themselves represented. And I love that Ella's out in the world. It makes me so emotional that if I talk about it for too long, I'll probably cry, because it just means so much to me. And I know that my younger self is like cheering right now.
Now, well, at the risk of making you emotional, tell us what Ella is trying to save the world from. Give us a taste of the book.
Yeah, so she is saving the world from a god of old who stole the light from humanity. So he... there's a lot of things going on, but basically she has to find a way to get the light back. And there's loads of different things in her way. She has to go to a mythos library and find different artifacts that are really in the history of this god of old that really intertwine into an amazing adventure story. And there's different landmarks within London where all of these different MacGuffins, I guess, are hidden. And she has to fight different things within each location with the Book of Incense, which this Book of Incense is very, it smells, but it's also full of Braille. But there's some historical accuracy to a few things in the book as well. And this is how we've kind of made the adventure quite wide reaching. But there's my favourite part of it is when they're in London Zoo. And there's a moment with Guide Dog Miss Maisie, which I loved writing with Katie, my co-author. It was brilliant. So, yeah.
All is silent. The man waits, his breathing heavy and uneven. "Come on," he whispers desperately, staring at it. "Come on." As though on cue, the lid falls back with an ear-splitting creak. A shimmering gold light bursts out and fills the room, so bright that the man yelps and shields his eyes. When it dims enough for him to lower his arm, he squints at the figure emerging now from the chest. He sees the white tunic that is torn and frayed, the long blonde hair tamed into a plait down the figure's back, the fair beard, unkempt and knotted. He is aware of the frame inside the tunic, too tall, too broad for this to be human, despite its manlike form. A large glass pendant hangs round the apparition's neck, swaying on a gold chain, glinting when it catches the light.
Now, the book takes you all over London, but you yourself, you've travelled all over the world. How does the UK measure up to other places in terms of accessible travel? And have you experienced something in another country that we definitely should have here?
Rob, oh my gosh, Japan is everything. When I filmed with the BBC, that documentary in Japan, I remember just walking out onto the street and the tactile lines there were out of this world. There was like little junction boxes. You could go left or right and really have the autonomy. I think back to London and going to Moorfields Eye Hospital, my stomping ground for years and years and years. And there is a line outside of Moorfields to go to the tube and it's very much trodden down now. You can't really feel it with your cane. So it's learning from Japan, I guess, that we can use different materials there. Even there was tactile lines onto the ferry when I was going across to Sado Island. And also, you know, you go into Shinkansens, which are the bullet trains, and into the toilet, and you've got a tactile map of the toilet layout, which is, side note, very, very clean. So I really appreciated all of that. I didn't need to get my Dettol wipes out and, understand where I was, which is just so lovely.
Lucy's full interview can be heard on Read On 4:15, and I'll be back next week with part two of A Review of 2025.
Books and accessible reading on RNIB Connect Radio.